am like multitasking with many different phones and a bunch of other things.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's October 6, 2015. Welcome to the regular meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. I would point out that we have emergency exits at the front and the rear of the room, to the rear, to my right, to the front, to my left. In case of a fire, please don't use the elevator. Also, please, if you have electronic devices, cell phones, anything that makes noise, and this includes legislators, by the way, please silence
making
them.
Noise?
Anything that makes noise that would interrupt our meeting.
Oh, man. I was like, it's going to be a short meeting. Nobody talk.
Is that a motion, Leslie?
Don't tempt me.
I wondered if folks would please stand with me and pledge allegiance to the flag. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. The clerk will call the roll, please.
Ms. Kiefer?
Present.
Mr. Klein?
Here.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Present.
Mr. McKenna?
Here.
Mr. Morey?
Here.
Ms. Robertson?
Here.
Mr. Sigler?
Here.
Mr. Stein?
Here.
Mr. Burbank?
Here.
Ms. Chalk?
Here.
Mr. Dennis?
Here.
Mr. Lane?
Here.
12 members present.
We have a quorum. Presentation of proclamations, petitions, communications, and notices.
Communications are on the desks.
We have one proclamation tonight, and it is regarding Freedom from Workplace Bullies Week. I don't think we have anybody here to receive that. Is that true? So I will simply indicate that we are proclaiming this as the week for remembering that any kind of bullying is bad, and certainly bullying in the workplace is bad. It makes things uncomfortable for other people, and it's not to be tolerated. So it's glad to be. We're glad to be reminded of that. We will be having an executive session tonight. It may go long, folks. I'll warn you ahead of time because we have several topics to discuss having to do with personnel and labor negotiations.
Is it time to revisit that no one speaks resolution?
Sorry? I'm all ears.
Go ahead.
Privilege of the floor. I notice we have a whole group of young people here. Is there a brave one among you who might stand up and tell us what school you're from and why you're in, that you're here, obviously, to observe our meeting? Someone want to tell us who we are?
And the brave one comes forward.
Hello, everyone. Good evening.
Evening.
Us here today are from Ithaca College, and we are part of a journalism class. And our lovely professor, Jill Loop, over here has tasked us with coming down here and taking notes with what's going on tonight, and we will be writing a piece on your agenda tonight. So thank you for having us, and we'll try to be quiet and respectful and enjoy it. Thank you, guys.
That's not necessary.
So, Leslie, they're writing this up, so be careful what we say.
I know. We have to be in our best behavior.
Thank you, and welcome, and we're glad to have you here tonight. We'll move to privilege of the floor for the public. This is the opportunity that anyone has to come and speak to us for up to 3 minutes. We ask that anyone who wants to speak to please sign one of these blue cards in the back. If you haven't already done that and you want to speak, please do that and hand it up. The rules for public speaking under privilege of the floor are that you agree to a 3-minute time limit, which we have a countdown clock to my left over here with an audible signal at the end. You agree not to raise your voice. You agree not to use lewd, obscene, profane, slanderous, or libelous language, or speak or act in a manner that would tend to incite a breach of peace. You agree not to speak about county personnel matters. Personnel matters include comments about the job performance of named county employees other than elected officials. After 3 minutes, you agree to leave the microphone and yield the floor, and you agree that if you cause a disruption and are asked to leave, you will leave the chambers. I have first tonight Monica Roth. Please state your name and where you're from.
The whole thing lowers, too.
Somebody help her there.
Somebody. On. Sorry. Okay. Hi. I'm Monica Roth with Cooperative Extension. It's a little. County Agriculture.
Just a second until he gets that adjusted. Okay. We won't hold this against your time.
Sorry, too short. Okay. All right. Anyhow, I'm here on behalf of the County Agriculture and Farmland Protection Board, and as a member of that board, I'm here to support the resolution that is listed under government operations, but I think Dooley will note that it's actually come out of the Planning Committee. The County Ag and Farmland Protection Board has been working on the County Ag Plan for almost 2 years. This was funding we received from the state to develop the plan. The plan has been completed, and we hope that you have seen it several times, perhaps, and it is on the website in the County Planning Department website. And the next step in the plan after county board approval is that it goes to the state for New York State Agriculture and Markets approval, and then it comes back to us, the County Ag and Farmland Protection Board, to begin working on all the many initiatives that were identified in the plan to address opportunities for agriculture economic development, opportunities for farmland protection, and overall for just strengthening the agriculture industry and ensuring its continuity in our county. It's an important sector, and it's a lot of what is happening out in our rural towns. There's a lot of agricultural activity, and that agricultural activity benefits the county in many ways. So we hope that you will support the resolution to adopt the plan. Thank you. And there's a couple of other members from the Ag and Farmland Board here, too, to speak briefly.
That's great. I have John Fleming next.
Hi. I'm also on the Ag and Farmland Board, and I'm a Lansing dairy farmer. So I'm also obviously in support of the plan that we've spent quite a bit of time on. Got a lot of input from many different sectors of agriculture, tried to be very inclusive in the plan. So we think that what we're presenting to you is going to be very productive for advancing agriculture in the county. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming and speaking. Lynn Davidson, please.
Hi there. I'm Lynn Davidson. I farm up in Lansing Crops. I just wanted to say that this has evolved, and I think most everything's been said, but I just would add that it's for all farms, both the value-added retail farms, CSAs, farmers market type delivery, as well as the larger farms. And I think it's a good thing to take a look at and go forward with. Thank you.
Thank you. And I'll try to move those resolutions up in a few minutes here. Ellie Kirshner.
Hi, my name's Ellie Kirshner. I'm a lifelong resident of Ithaca, and now I am a Cornell student. And this November I'll be running to serve as the 4th District Representative. And I just wanted to come up and briefly introduce myself. I've met many of you in this room, and I look forward to meeting more of you. And the past year has been a dream come true getting involved in my local community, and I hope I'll have the opportunity to do more, and I'm looking forward to getting to know and learning from all of you, and I'm just very excited. So thank you for having me here.
Thank you. I'm not seeing a municipal official, am I? Who'd like to speak? So let's go to privilege of the floor for legislators. Jim Dennis.
Very short. I put on all of your desks a palm card from the Kitchen Theater. There is a play there October 11th through October 25th, a two-week run. It is called The Mountaintop by Katori Hall, And I had the privilege of watching like 30 minutes of it last week, and sort of the actors were still learning their lines and the set was half built. It's a play about the last night of Martin Luther King Jr. in Memphis, Tennessee, in a motel room. And it's, I believe it will be startling, and so please try to make it.
Thank you. Martha Robertson.
Thank you, Mike. I am just want to mention that this little brochure is about the day reporting program, and I was one of a lot of people who went yesterday to the open house for the new day reporting facility in the Human Services Building. Had a run through really quickly because we had a committee meeting right after. But the it's a great space. Big kudos to the facilities crew, facilities people who made it happen, to the Social Services Department as well as DSS as well as probation who collaborated and made sure that they. All the various needs of both departments could be met. It really seems fantastic. A real improvement in a facility for a very, very important program. And the LIVC conference room still exists. It's smaller, but we were working on other meeting spaces for the county. But it felt really wonderful to. Finally, have that program in a professional, welcoming, bright, acceptable kind of a space, and to be out of the old library. So I invite anybody, if you weren't able to get to the open house, I'm sure Pat and her staff would accommodate. Nodding. Pat's nodding, yes. Go make sure you to stop in to see the new facility. Thanks.
Will Burbank, then Carol Chalk.
Thanks, Mike. A couple weeks ago, I had the pleasure of being part of a group from the Strategic Tourism Planning Group that did a kind of an inaugural ride along the now completed waterfront trail. As you know, this was done in three parts, and they late summer finished the middle section. You can now bike or cycle all the way from the Convention and Visitors Bureau, essentially to Cass Park, the skating rink, and around the Freeman Marina. It was really neat. Is that a number of members of STPB got on bikes. Those that didn't have bikes went to Ithaca Bike Rental, which I only recently became aware of, but it exists. It's a wonderful thing if you know somebody in town that wants to get a bike for a few hours. And then we stopped at a series of spots along the trail that had been funded by STPB. And it was just a very, very informative introduction to some very, very exciting projects in our community. So I mention this because if you have any interest in biking, go out and do it. Or if you would like to bike with me, I'd love going along, and I'd happy to recreate the tour with anybody who would like. And that's my read.
Thank you, Wills. That sounds nice. Carol?
And maybe somebody could take me on the back of there in a geriatric seat. I wanted to recognize all of the incredible events that have been happening in downtown Ithaca, and one in particular. There's just such a wealth of activity happening with the opening of the Commons and the Apple Festival downtown, and that's a professionally administered event. Every time I drive past Southside Center, there's more music and poetry and farmers market activity happening there. An event that if you've never gone to, watch for next year, is one that is really put on by volunteers. Porch Fest, Fall Creek neighborhood, has grown over the years, started with, it's symbolic of what can be done when something really grows from the grassroots. Started with a few musicians playing on porches in the summertime, and neighbors wandering by and saying, boy, we ought to do this. We ought to do more of this. And it growing to a few more porches in the neighboring blocks, and it grew from there to a date picked. And it has now grown to over 100 musicians, I think, a whole afternoon from noon or 1 o'clock till 6 o'clock, food trucks, sets of porches throughout the entire neighborhood, and really has grown organically. They do such an amazing job, and I can't even find in the brochure the names of the people who've done all this work, because they're mostly volunteers. They've raised a little bit of money from some sponsors, but mostly it's all donated. So kudos to the Fall Creek neighborhood and the people who put that on, and I urge you to watch for it next year.
Dan, then Dave.
The Environmental Management Council is the group that advises the county legislature on environmental issues. And this group is formed by state legislation from several decades ago. Every year, the Environmental Management Councils in the state get together for an annual conference. This year, the conference is in Ithaca, and it's taking place October 15th, 16th, and 17th. So if you want to find out more information about the speakers that they'll be having and the field trips that they'll be taking, then just Google it. You'll be able to find it pretty easily. It's aimed at Environmental Management Council members from around the state, also members of town conservation advisory councils, and then it's just also open to the general public as well. It's anybody that has an interest in local environmental issues.
The date again, please?
October 15th, 16th, and 17th.
16th and
yeah,
17th.
That's right. Most of it happens on the 16th and 17th.
Friday and where? Saturday. Where are the
various places.
Oh.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dan. Dave?
Yeah, I'm also a member of the Ag and Farmland Board, and I'm here to lobby everybody on this board to vote in favor of the Ag and Farmland Plan. These people have worked really hard on this for the last couple of years, and I believe it's well written and it's well thought out and deserving of being adopted. So that's it.
Thank you. Anyone else? Carol again?
Oh, I'm just informed that Leslie Green is the name of the person whose name should be on this brochure, was the chief organizer of that Porch Fest event.
That's very nice. Thank you. Before we go on to the special topical presentation, can we take this issue of the ag plan? Dooley, would you be willing to move the two resolutions? I know they are on consent, but let's get them taken care of.
And they're also listed under government operations, but I'm very happy to move
them. Could you move I and J, please?
Yes, I would like to very much, if I can find them. We have such big agendas. I'm shuffling through pages.
I and J.
Thank you. I is ID 5833, making a negative declaration of environmental significance in relation to resolution number, yet to be numbered, of 2015, adoption of the 2015 Tompkins Agriculture and Farmland Protection Plan. I so move.
Is there a second? Seconded by Martha Robertson. Discussion?
You've already heard how much of the public has been involved in this, and it's been very well handled, I think, in that regard. And we're delighted that it includes recognition of changes in the climate that also will affect farmers.
Carol?
Yeah, I also wanted to thank the people who worked on this, Monica and Debbie and the staff there and others who not only went through the whole process, which is extensive, but came many times to our committee and responded with changes that and iterations of this plan as it went along. So I really appreciate their responsiveness to some of our new concerns.
All right, are we ready to vote? Those in favor of the resolution, please raise your hand.
Aye.
Those opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you, Dooley. Could you move, Jay?
Yes. Resolution J, identification number 5834, adoption of the 2015 Tompkins County Agriculture and Farmland Protection Plan. I so move.
Seconded by Dave McKenna. Discussion? Ready to vote? All those in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That's unanimous. And yes, you have the thanks of all of Tompkins County for the work that was done on this great project. Thanks, and thanks for coming tonight and speaking about it. Okay, we'll go back, and we're going to have a presentation tonight from Pat Buchel, our Commissioner of Probation. We need to put down the screens. We'll suspend while the screens go down. See, Pat is joined by Susie Cook from County Attorney's Office and Deb Dietrich from OAR.
Thanks,
Thank you.
Michael. Good evening.
I would say offender aid and restoration, but I know that's not right anymore.
I still say that. So my name is Susie Cook, and I chair the county's Criminal Justice ATI Board. You'll recall that in November of 2013, there was a proposal to add the 7 additional beds at the jail, and it sparked a rather lively debate about putting money towards the ATIs rather than towards housing additional inmates. The legislature wisely chose to do both, and CJATI supported that. Adding the beds to lower the board outs and then asking CJATI to undertake a study to find additional ways to further lower the jail population. The Jail Alternatives Task Force undertook that and reported out its findings in July of 2014. Some of the key findings were that Tompkins County, who has one of the lowest incarceration rates in the state, has a very wide array of effective formal and informal ATIs, and that there's a lot of grassroots initiatives, but the problem was there needed to be coordination and referral to these resources. The other thing we believed could make a significant difference was to look at reentry, which is trying to better transition the inmates out of the jail and back into the community to stop this revolving door cycle of getting arrested, coming out of jail, going back in. What were those stopgap supports that might make a difference and allow them to make better choices? So in early 2015, CJATI created the reentry subcommittee to specifically look at a reentry program. It was co-chaired by Pat Buchel, our probation director, and Deb Dietrich of OAR, and they've done an incredible job. You will notice that the members are varied and come from many areas of our criminal justice system. The public members who were the public guest participants actually were passionate and dedicated and brought a lot of expertise to it. The charge to the committee, other than what I've said, is looking at identifying alternative funding sources. We know that times are tight, a statistical means of tracking the recidivism. Look at other programs, not in reinventing the wheel. They've done an admirable job and worked for many months to come up with the information. The full report is also on the county website.
So the process for the RES subcommittee, we met 13 times beginning in February of 2015. Our meetings really and topics of the meetings really built on each other. We heard from many Tompkins County service providers and other county reentry programs. We heard from Broome and Onondaga County, who each operate a reentry effort. And as a result of that process, we compiled this report, which I believe all of you have in your packets. So why are we talking about reentry? I think everyone's pretty aware that there's a revolving door syndrome of a certain population that cycles in and out of the jail. They get rearrested, they go back in the jail, they get out, they maybe do okay for a little while, and then they're rearrested again. So that's one of the issues that this reentry concept addresses. We have a lack of coordination of existing services. Many of us work in silos. We only work with, you know, our certain respective service. We don't necessarily talk with each other. So that was an identified need of reentry that may assist people. We have a substance abuse issue with inmates in the jail. Many, many of them have substance abuse problems that do not get addressed. They come out of the jail and are back to using drugs right away. We have instability in housing. Many people are in kind of substandard single-room occupancy. The survey that we conducted in the jail of the inmates, I think 50% of both men and women were either unsure, were going to be couch surfing when they got out of jail, or were going to be homeless. So that was a major issue. And then, of course, the rising cost of incarceration is an issue with board-out costs, transportation costs, and all those associated problems. So the committee did come up with characteristics of the inmates in our jail, and this is just some of those statistics. You'll see that in 2014, we had a total of 794 inmates in the jail. 543 were unsentenced. 251 were sentenced inmates. So the larger proportion are the unsentenced population. You'll see some demographics there of age ranges. You know, 64% were under the age of 33, so we really are looking at a younger population that's incarcerated. There's some demographics on race, 80% male, 20% female. And then of the sentenced population, the majority in there are convicted of a misdemeanor, 20% for a felony, and 14% convicted of other types of offenses, which are usually the violation-level offenses. I think I talked about the substance abuse issue. 68% of the jail inmates meet the criteria for substance abuse nationally, and 16% suffer from mental illness nationally. We don't have that specific data for our inmates in the jail, but we believe that that mirrors the national statistics, and that's just based really on anecdotal information. And nationally, 80% of all jail inmates are incarcerated for less than a month. And in Tompkins County, that's very similar. I believe the average is 35 days. So that really gives you a sense of how difficult it is to be working with the population that's in the jail for a limited time period. And how do we provide services for people who are only in there when many of the evidence-based programs are 6 weeks, 12 weeks in duration. In 2008, Tompkins County initiated an informal pilot reentry project that was initially, there were many stakeholders who were sitting around the table, but over the years that has dwindled down to four main players. There's a probation staff person, OAR, there's a corrections officer, and who am I missing?
Casey Monahan.
Casey Monahan from the jail, who does the jail evaluations. None of those individuals are solely dedicated to that effort. They are all doing their everyday jobs, but they are able to provide, you know, a few hours a week to the service. The data that's been collected by that program shows that we've served 143 individuals over that time period since 2008. But when we did the math, we saw that there was actually over 1,000 people sentenced at the jail during that time period, and so we've only really served 14%. But of that 143 people served, 64.3% have not returned to the jail. So that told us that even with the limited efforts that we were providing with this pilot program, we were on the right track.
So coming out of this, we really identified some major barriers to successful reentry. Being a rural county, it makes some of those barriers somewhat different. We have some of the barriers in common with all other municipalities, and then there's some that are unique to being a rural upstate county. The lack of coordination is really was a major thing that just kept emerging. Housing just rises to the top. If someone doesn't know where they're sleeping or living that night, they can't begin to think about some of these other issues, such as employment, continuing education. ID, identification. Actually, we've made some progress before even finishing our work in getting that streamlined a little bit with motor vehicle departments. So it's helpful that people are getting IDs a little bit more quickly. Transportation is a huge, huge barrier to successful reentry in this community. Many of the people who are coming out of the jail, if they're housed at all, are housed in single-room occupancies in the townships of Groton and Enfield, and a smaller number in Dryden. And the buses run on a regular 9-to-5 schedule, so that there are people who are really, if you're lucky enough to have a job at all, you're going to have a job in the service sector, generally, when you come out. And so those service sector jobs don't, they're not 9-to-5 jobs. And then finally, there's a real lack of coordination of drug and alcohol treatment and mental health treatment in this community, and a shortage of in-jail programming space. Though the jail has been very accommodating to a number of programs that have come in and are running separate things, trainings such as GED. OAR ran a course for women in the jail a couple of years ago, but there really just is a shortage of space to have ongoing programming. So these are our recommendations. We recommended that the county consider two full-time reentry coordinator discharge planner positions. One would be the discharge planner would be in the jail working with people throughout their time in the jail. Though 30 days is the average stay, there are people who are there longer, but you have to make a plan on what you're going to do when you get out. And a reentry coordinator to really coordinate the wealth of services that this county has for those individuals once they get out. And some of that's as simple as getting them to the appointment at mental health, and then making sure they make it from mental health to DSS, and just working closely with people until they get used to functioning on the outside. We have people cycling in and out all the time. There are a lot of other specific recommendations here. I think I want to hit on the housing issue, because that just keeps coming to the top. And we've had conversations with TCA and other housing providers. And we call it transitional housing here. But basically, it's what we're looking at is supportive housing. Many of the people that we serve at the county jail really need supportive housing when they get out. They need someone to be there, like a resident advisor, to just help them get through the system, figure out what the next steps are. And some are going to need supportive housing, quite frankly, all their lives. Our jail is housing increasing numbers of mentally ill. And this isn't not all of our clients are people who are going to move into fully independent living in a suburb in the town of Ithaca, which we'd all dream about, that everyone could move through that process. But some of these folks are going to be long-term dependents on the society. So we also realize that we need to collaborate with a lot of the other local initiatives. And it's an exciting time. There's a lot of local interest in this issue. There's a lot of energy around it, and there's a decent amount of private funding, foundation funding, coming in to these efforts. So we work closely with the Ultimate Reentry Opportunity, which some of you may have heard about, which has gotten funding from the Park Foundation to begin to implement the mentoring programs that are one of the last recommendations. We invited them to all of our meetings. We've got one that one member that's been a regular and another that was a guest. So we're working across all the various groups to try to get all the energy kind of pulled together so that we can come up with some community solutions to the problem of our citizens cycling in and out of the Tompkins County Jail. Let's kind of leave some time for some questions.
Questions? Martha Robertson.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate all this work, and I hope everybody really did read through this and give it some time and attention. I am one thing about housing. I've heard a lot about housing first as kind of it's a buzz phrase, but I've heard it with respect of veterans in particular. The idea of if say veterans have, there's a lot of attention, a lot of extra programs for veterans, you know, rightly so, that address substance abuse and mental health. But it's been identified that you have to get them in a stable place first. You have to start by providing housing first, and then you can you can address and they can begin to work on other issues. So I think that's exactly right. I agree with what you said. And as you know, it's also a huge, huge issue for the community. You say increase the safety net housing allowance. Can you explain that? That is, safety net is one of our social service programs or mandates.
Yes, it's one of your mandated social service programs. There's an amount set of $400 per month by the state of New York for the safety net housing. But that doesn't preclude a local government from increasing it. You'll only get reimbursed, however, from the state for 50% of the 400. So that if you were to increase the safety net housing allowance, that would be total local cost, anything over $400. It couldn't be done in isolation, though, because what we have is we have a handful of slumlords in this community who house the majority of the people coming out of the jail. And who don't have private family housing or housing with someone else. And so if you were to just simply increase the safety net allowance without any code enforcement or enforcement of standards, you would simply get this handful of landlords charging $600 a month. So it's not something to be done in isolation. It's really something I think that the county has to decide whether it wants to put county taxpayers into housing people in some substandard housing.
Do you think there's a level at which the supply would be more available, or is that like beyond what we could even consider?
I really don't. I think that we have to create more units. We know we have less than a 1% vacancy in this community. I think that an increase some could maybe pull a few more landlords into the picture. I don't think, however, that it's going to solve the problem. We couldn't raise it enough. I mean, when a studio apartment is going for, $900 minimum, you just can't do it.
Okay, thank you.
Will, then Jim, then Peter.
So your top bullet is reentry coordinators or reentry positions. Did you envision those operating? It was clear where they would be, county staff or OAR or.
No, there was not a consensus on that or even really much discussion. We were just talking about this more abstractly, but knowing that we're going to need these positions, I think there's a thought that one of the positions may fit very well in the new day reporting, but very little discussions happened about that, and that's one of the reasons that there isn't we didn't get a proposal to you in time to be included in any individual department's budget.
So as always, money will be the issue, and I'm wondering if there is a economic case to be made that having these positions, which will cost X number of dollars a year, would actually save the county in terms of lowered board-out costs or jail population, certainly in terms of the human impact of people cycling in and out of jail. But I'm just wondering whether there's been any studies elsewhere that a more proactive reentry program actually saves money. Is it?
What we have found, Will, is that it kind of depends on the size of the county. Some of the big counties are getting big bucks from DCJS. Yeah. Then there's the question of whether reentry is voluntary. You know, and some now they're making reentry mandatory, if they're getting state and federal funds. We know that coordination of what we have is the first step. We haven't fleshed out yet. This is just kind of our groundwork right here of what we need to continue to do, of where it would best be served, what department, what the duties will specifically be. We do know it will answer back to CJATI, because I think that was one of the reasons, that we've kind of faltered on the initial one is the lack of dedicated, personnel. We all have other full-time jobs. Mm. So the coordination piece will be key, but we're not sure yet where the best place for that will be.
Okay. Thank you.
And I would love to make the economic argument that it will save, that it won't save over a 12-month period, and we really need good data collection in order to be able to quantify some of those savings to report back over time.
Thanks.
Jim, Peter, Carol, Mike. Jim?
Yeah. I have sort of a distorted view because
Peter, it's Jim Neck. Jim,
what?
No. You want me to let Peter go?
Yeah.
Jim was ahead of you. Go ahead, Peter.
I talk too much anyway. Go ahead.
Go ahead, Peter.
So I drive people to the jail, and the people are always women, and their girlfriends or wives.
Or both.
I wonder, I have no idea what fraction of the jail population I'm seeing, but I'm wondering what happens to those people when they get out of jail. Do they move in with the girlfriend, or can they get their own room that can accommodate their families, or what?
I think there are a range of issues facing that. There are Section 8 rules. Many of those individuals may have Section 8 housing, and it may not allow another person to join that household when they leave the jail, so that they may find themselves at the shelter temporarily. They may find themselves couch surfing with other places, or they may be living with that girlfriend or wife under the radar of Section 8.
I mean, it would be really bad if you came out of jail and then you could not join your partner that was yours before you went into jail.
That happens.
I mean, I would think you would want to make sure that those families are reunited in some way. I have no idea how, but all right.
That would be a good role for the coordinator to be talking about discharge. Where are you going to be living when you get out? Who are you going to be living with? Let's make sure you have a place. Let's contact that person to make sure that you can live there so that when they do walk out, they know where they're going. And they're not going to be knocking on someone's door and saying, can I sleep on your couch tonight, you know, for the next. So that's the vision.
Back to Jim.
If you had a reentry coordinator, would they be stationed up at the jail when people came out? I mean, describe, you know, 6 hours of a person's day. If someone is getting out of jail, what would that person do immediately? Where would they be? How would they know who was getting out, all that?
Well, I think it's called InReach, so I think the coordinator would be stationed up at the jail. I mean, these are details we would need to work out, but this is kind of my vision, that they would be looking at the roster of who's come in, immediately start working with that person that day, because we only have a very short period of time to try to figure out the services that this person's going to need, and then prioritizing. If they're a low-risk person where they have a job to return to, they have a house to return to, we're not going to spend a lot of time with those people. But if it's the person who needs and doesn't have any place to live and no job, then obviously the coordinator is going to be involved more in setting up some kind of plan. So I see inside, and then I see outside, where the person actually, like as Deb said, follows up with the person, makes sure that reminds them about appointments, let's go to the appointment, helping with housing, helping with employment. So there's like it's kind of a separation of duties. But that's
one of the problems is when they come out, they might have a plan, but then there could be no, there's no follow through. There's no hand holding, you know, when they come out. And that's, I think having someone navigate that is one of the things that we're looking at.
I have Carol, then Mike Sigler. I have a question, and then Martha would like to ask another question.
Well, two things. One is on the encouraging of the hiring of ex-offenders. Do you see that as being an outreach program for employers or a matter of the banning the box, as we've talked about?
I think there's a range of approaches to that. I think a reentry coordinator would probably work a good chunk of their time in developing relationships with employers in the community. But I also think I know that both the city and county have been looking at banning the box, and I think that's not the end-all answer to the issue of employment, but it's a start. So I think it's a multi-pronged approach to doing encouraging the hiring.
Yeah, and we talked about this a little bit at committee, so I won't repeat all of it, but it just, the report really struck me with the, in the questions that we asked, or that you guys did an incredible job of asking of people who'd been through the program or who hadn't, where they thought an impact would be made on their own lives, and the inability of people to see that there was anything that was going to help, that the sense of hopelessness coming out, you know, among females around 20%, 10 to 20%, but among males, you know, a long list of items, 2%, 10, 5% of people thought, well, that might do some good. So just the sense of hopelessness that there's just, I'm coming out into a world that isn't going to make a place for me, or that didn't have a place for me to begin with, is maybe beyond scope here, but it's, I really appreciate your identifying the places that we could start. Thank you.
Mike Sigler?
I'm a little quiet. I'm curious about, like, kind of the mentality of people coming out, though. Like, I mean, you were saying something like 80% of the people are on some type of drug, about that.
68.
I mean, out of that 68, I mean, some of these guys are, you know, addicted to heroin.
Yeah.
You're not giving that up in 30 days. So they're getting out. I mean, how many of them just really like drugs? Like, I'm going to go back out and I'm just going to start taking drugs again because I really like them. And what do you kind of do with that?
I will just share what I know. You know, we've had juveniles move through our system and we see them grow up. And I have seen success in a program in Binghamton where they actually were hospitalized for 28 days to dry out, and then they proceeded into transitional housing. That transitional housing had AA in-house. It had someone living there 24/7. That helped, and it was primarily the young male population, which we see. And they would move them into part-time at the community college, or they would help them get a job. And they were there every step of the way, walking them through it, making sure they were sober. Then they transitioned into an apartment with another successful person in that program. And I saw this work time and time again. Then it lost its funding. But that model seemed to be good, especially for the younger male population. And frequently with people with addiction issues, it takes repeated treatment sometimes. They frequently don't get it the first time. Sometimes they just have to grow up. But that model seemed to be, I mean, that would be like the dream. But
I also think you have to distinguish between liking a drug and being addicted to a drug or alcohol. I think everyone likes, my experience is most people have liked a drug or like a drink. But there's quite a difference between liking that and becoming addicted, where it becomes really a physical need. And so by the time you're addicted, it's really not, you don't even really consider whether you're liking it anymore. It's something you have to do. So we have to break that. So I think that a lot of the self-help groups help a lot after a detox situation.
And I would like to add that, you know, many people who are addicted to drugs have experienced...
Can you get closer to the microphone, Pat?
Many people who are addicted have experienced major trauma in their life. I mean, many, many experiences of trauma. So the drugs are a way of self-medicating from that trauma that they've experienced. It's not a... I mean, I think, you know, addiction is misery. It brings misery to people. And so when you say mentality, I think... you know, people are self-medicating and trying to get away from that misery and that trauma that many of us are lucky not to have experienced. But
thanks. I had a question about the jail statistics that were up there. I guess I was kind of surprised that as many as 20% of the people in our jail are female. I would have guessed lower number. And I'm wondering, are we seeing more female inmates?
Yes, definitely.
And can I just say from my standpoint, I continue to worry about the fact that we often board out female inmates even more than male. And I wondered if you had any comments on that.
Well, if I could speak to it briefly, we're seeing it. They're petty larcenies frequently. They're crimes that are usually associated with drugs and alcohol. The board outs, the females and juveniles are the two groups that are boarded out because of classification most frequently. It is one of the reasons that OAR supported the addition of 7 beds so that there wouldn't be as many board outs, that we could reach these people. But it's disturbing because juveniles and females have frequently children or parents that could be most helpful in staying in close contact with, and yet they end up in the neighboring counties out of reach.
Martha, you wanted to thank you for that. We had another question from Martha, one more from Peter, and then let's see if we can come to a conclusion.
Yeah, I understand that you can't always do your work according to the schedule of the budget calendar. And I appreciate your coming here and to the Public Safety Committee earlier today. I think the need is clearly documented. This is really our response to the community. When we agreed to go ahead and increase the number of beds in the jail, but also to say, okay, we haven't checked in about our ATI programs in a while. Let's do this review. This is the review. These are the results, and these are, another slide. These are the recommendations. I think, if these folks easily fit into the slots of how a person makes their way through the world, they wouldn't be in this situation. They need extra opportunities. They need extra attention. And, Carrie Blakinger has talked to many of us of her experience in the jail and in detox. And, the first couple of days, that's your detox. And if you don't have anything to follow that up, if you don't have any support in working your way through that, you've gone through the painful process of detox, but you can't actually make anything of it because then you get dumped back on the street and nothing else has been solved. You're back exactly in the situation you were in before. So I'm going to put together a resolution to bring, I'll send it to Kevin. I hope I'll work with you guys on an amount of money that we could park in the contingent fund and figure out what the an appropriate number is so that we can identify it, target funding to identify it for to address these needs, and then as the year goes through, in 2016 goes through, and the proposals get honed and go through the Public Safety Committee and the legislature, then that funding will be there for the 2016 budget. So I think that, this has been a really important process, well documented. And, the thing about the coordinator is we really do have a lot of services here that we're already paying for. But these are folks who just can't navigate all that on their own. And these coordinator kind of positions, handholders, if you will, are really what's missing. So I thank you very, very much for all this work. And, I'll talk to you further about what we can put in for a motion.
Thank you.
Peter, wrap us up.
Yeah, it's hard to wrap these things up. And I saw jail statistics a year ago or 2 years ago, hard to keep it straight. The vast majority of the inmates were there for less than a week. So I gather we're not talking about those people. I gather we're talking about people that have been there for a significant amount of time, right?
We're talking about a continuum, I think.
It depends on what they need. Somebody may be in there for a week and they just need an ID card or something, but it depends on what they need. But people who have the resources, we won't. That would not be the priority.
Right. Okay. But for someone who's been there a long time, they must not be addicted anymore because they have not had the ability to procure their drugs on a regular basis. So you start out from that position, I would think, when you leave the jail. Is that correct?
I think what you need to be careful of is when they get out, they need different housing than falling back in with the crowd.
Than the crowd,
that they
right.
hung with that
right.
got them in trouble in the first place.
Because the difference is, too, they may not be addicted, but they may not be recovering yet, meaning that they have to make some life changes over a period of time. It's not just a physical addiction. And so it's what Susie was saying is new places, new friends.
Do they have that opportunity while they're inmates in the jail to go through a recovery program so that they can come out cured, so to speak?
I think what they have is AA meetings, but I don't think there's a medically, there's no medical treatment. Like inpatient rehab, that's not what we have up there.
Because, Peter, most of the people are going to be in there 1 year or less, so, you know, that's a problem.
Okay, well, all three of you, thank you for a great report, and thank your group for the work that they did in putting that together. Very clear and very helpful to us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll put the screens up. We'll stop for a minute. Okay. For my report, I just want to speak to one thing tonight, and that has to do with the fact that we know we have two vacancies on this legislature, and that means we're having two special elections, both of which are falling concurrently with the general election in November. There's been some misunderstanding, I think, of the process and a mixture of misunderstanding about the charter, the resignation dates, and other things. The charter indicates in its provisions, depending on when a resignation is effective, when the election is held. If in a small window between time in August and September, the election is held during the general election. Other times, this legislature will set a date not more than 75 days later. That was what happened when Brian Robison resigned from this, and we set the special election that occurred last February, I think it was, which Glenn Morey was elected. Some people have been saying, well, there's no primary. There's no time here for a primary. There is never a primary in a special election, and that is not our charter that decides that. That is decided by New York State election law, which governs the system and the procedures for a special election. When a special election happens, the parties, through their officials, which are the committee people in the district which is vacant, nominate their candidate for office. There's also a window in which there can be a petition for independents who wish to nominate. In these two districts, the number of signatures needed to run as an independent is pretty small. I think it was 24 signatures in District 4 and 62 in District 2. For those folks that think that the timing here, because we're doing the election in November, meant that we weren't giving people a chance for a primary, there would never be a primary in one of these vacancy special elections. So I just wanted to make that clear so folks understand that. I think each of you after the last meeting was given a copy of the section of the charter. Kathy sent it out, Kathy Covert. Having to do with the vacancies and how they are filled. But it's the state election law that has the procedure for the actual election itself. I don't have any appointments. Let's go to a report by our county administrator, Joe Mariana.
Thanks, Mike. I just have two brief items, both budget-related, and then I'd like to yield my time to Paula, who'd like to update you briefly on the DOJ in the study. So the two budget items in this room tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, is the community budget forum. If you liked the PowerPoint in September, you'll love it in October. There's a little bit of an overlap there, but it's an informal opportunity for people to come to understand our budget and provide some input into it. So, again, that's in this room tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. Yeah, the budget item is amendments. We've received some already. If you can get yours in, I think the date we've set is Thursday, I think mid-afternoon. So if you're able to get those amendments in by that time, that'll be very helpful in getting them all collected and back to you in terms of an understandable list for you to act on later on in this process. So those are the two budget-related items. If there's no questions on that, if I can ask Paula just to briefly update.
Paula Younger is our Deputy County Administrator.
Thanks, Mike. Good evening, everyone. Just to give you a quick update on where we are with the request to the Department of Justice for technical assistance with regard to the after-action report on Hornbrook Road. If you recall, several months ago, we approached the Department of Justice through their Bureau of Justice Assistance. They were unable to accommodate our request, and that request came directly from this body. However, BJA referred us to their COPS office, which is another internal bureau, which is community-oriented policing services. And they were able to talk us through their process for technical assistance. But it could not come directly from the legislature. It had to come from the sheriff's office. That took us on a journey of just doing a quick revamp of our original TA request document. And that became a letter that was signed by our sheriff. We also asked the chief of police of the city of Ithaca to sign on giving support, as well as the town supervisor from Danby. And we also got that signature. And then, of course, the letter was also signed by a county administrator and the chair of the legislature. A lot has transpired over the past 30 days. On September 17th, we were able to have a conference call with the Department of Justice COPS office. Involved in that conference call was the sheriff, the undersheriff, and myself. It was about a one-hour conversation, quite detailed, just asking some general questions, clarifications of the TA request document, also giving us heads up on how they do business when they come on site, letting us know that this could be a process for them that could take anywhere from 8 to 10 months. And once the request is officially approved, it would be about a month before they would be on site. They also had an opportunity to have a conference call with Chief Barber from IPD, and they also had an opportunity to have a conversation with the Danby Town Supervisor, Rick Dietrich. So now we are at the process of them taking all of that information, including the after-action report that the sheriff's office prepared, which, by the way, during the course of the conversation with DOJ, they actually gave kudos to our sheriff's office for preparing that report. That's not necessarily standard operating procedure, but they were being very responsive to this body as well as to members of the community, and DOJ actually found the report to be quite helpful and informative, and I thought you should know that. So we're waiting for them to consider all the information they have thus far, all the conversations that they've had and so forth, and it's my understanding that they are going to be contacting me later on next week to give me a final decision as to whether or not the TA request is actually approved, and that would mean they would begin to come on site and carry through with the after-action review.
Paul, if you could stay. We got a couple questions. Will and then Carol.
Thank you, Paul. If they do approve it, what would be the nature of their service and how would that be different from what we had asked for?
Well, we were asking for an independent review, so an outside source, but with the expertise, particularly in law enforcement tactical operations, to look at the activities, that evening and make recommendations, whether that means there's something that we should do differently, things that we need to improve, or whether we are in line with standards and best practice. And then we would also look for something in writing to support that. And that would also be, I would assume, kind of a capacity-building document moving forward, that if there are opportunities for, like, future training or updating of policies or protocols, they would be able to tell us that.
Okay, so that's what they can offer. And is that essentially similar to what we had originally had asked for?
It is. I mean, the focus really is more on law enforcement, because this is coming from the cop's office. However, one of the things that they did say, and pardon me, I'm just looking at my notes here, is that they really are very much interested in the history. I think if you all remember, we talked about, you know, those 13 attempts previously to, you know, present the warrant and some of the other wraparound services, you know, the alcohol and drug treatment services and things like that that were a part of the history of this that led to this incident. Now, as to what degree they're going to be able to look into that, I don't know. That has not been discussed, but they did indicate that was important data to have and important areas to look into if they come on board to do the review.
Thank you.
Carol, then Martha.
My question got answered.
Carol or Martha?
Just a comment. That's I think, what the last thing you said about the history and treatment and you know, the previous attempts was what the first agency, was it the DOJ, whatever.
The Bureau of Justice Assistance.
said they couldn't do. So,
well, I think it was a rather comprehensive TA assignment for them, and exactly why they couldn't do it, I don't know. Like I said, it's not that the cops office has offered any detail as to how much they might delve into these areas, but they just referenced the fact that was important to consider in their review.
I think that's really a step in the right direction. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Paula. Joe, anything else? Let's move to Jonathan Wood, our county attorney.
I do not have a report.
Questions for Jonathan? Our finance director is Rick Snyder.
I have a question for Jonathan.
Oh, sure.
I just wondered the status of the microbead draft law.
I have drafted a microbead draft law and a memo on my recommendations, and they will be on the agenda for your committee.
Okay. Rick?
Thank you, Mike. I have two things to report tonight. First, on page 33 of your packet, I'd like to bring your attention to the August sales tax figures. The county's portion of sales tax distributions for August was up 0.45% compared to last year. If you're looking at the sheet, it's the middle section, lines 6 and 7. That's designated county or county share. As of the end of August, year-to-date tax distributions for the county's portion total $21,159,886 compared to $21,450,266 in 2014. This represents a decrease of $290,380 year-over-year, or 1.35%. So that 1.35% in the right-hand column there that shows how much we're under last year's figures, that figure has slowly becoming smaller and smaller each of the last two or three months, because, as you know, the first 4 or 5 months of this year we had dismal sales tax collections. The last two or three months have been very healthy, as in July and August, our figures were actually exceeding last year's July and August figures. So those are good signs of a slight recovery happening. But we monitored this and look forward to the September figures that are coming in, and that those end of quarter, third quarter figures should be available before our next legislative meeting, which is on the 20th of this month. So within about 2 weeks, we should have third quarter figures for you. The only other item I have to report is the sale of bands, which are bond anticipation notes, which we sold and priced these on the market on September 30th, 2015, just a short while ago. These bands were renewal bands, which took the place of one-year bands that we sold last year at this time. The bond anticipation notes totaled $3,240,000, and they came in at a net interest rate of 0.5730%. They were sold to TD Securities USA, which were the same buyers of our of the same note last year at this time. These notes have a maturity of 1 year. The bands were issued to continue the financing of the Ellis Hollow Phase 2 road reconstruction project, and the note closing was held today, October 6th, just a little while ago at 3 o'clock before our meetings began. And for your comparison, if you'd like to compare the 0.57% that we got on these notes, just for your information, in July 2015, which was just a few months back, we sold some bands at an interest rate of 0.76%. In November of 2014, just 1 year ago, we sold bands at 0.27%. In July of 2014, our bands were at 0.18%. And in July of 2013, our band sold at 0.36%. So it's up and down a little bit. These sold right pretty much in the middle, about an average of the last four issuances that we did at bands. And that's all I have to report tonight, Mike.
Thank you, Rick. Questions? I had Carol, then Martha.
Yeah, as I looked at this in advance, I noticed, and I was trying to remember, over time, was my perception correct that the drop was closing? And so I'm glad to hear you confirming that the negative number is getting smaller in our sales tax receipts. Sorry, and I do wonder whether it would be helpful for us at some point, doesn't have to be immediately, but to think about how to show this over time in a bar graph. It just seems like it should be fairly easy to do, to show what the sales tax receipts were in dollars and then in the percent difference, or either in percent change or dollar change over time, with the difference coming out in a different color at the top, and either a different color at the top if it's a positive number, and a hashed different color at the top if it's a negative number. But it would give us a sense over time about how this is changing, and I'd see it over, 5 years. And then once we had that template to do, it would be easy to keep doing. So.
Yeah, I think we could do that. I think your remarks, I noted your remarks the last time we gave a quarterly report, I believe it was, and we're working. I'd like to work on a graph that will show exactly what you're asking for there. Hopefully, we'll have that for the next report.
Yeah, well, it's no rush, but just over time would give us a sense. Thanks,
Martha.
Thanks, Rick. On our desk, we have the contingent report of the contingent account, and maybe we'll talk about. Maybe I'm jumping ahead and talking about this before we get to our resolutions, but. I don't remember ever seeing a balance in October that's less than $18,000. I know you have a different approach, in particular with the Sheriff's Department, where it was a really big number, a big request. You wanted to have that come mid-year instead of at the end of the year. I guess my question is, do you see any other – is this a problem? That we got so low?
Well, in other years, you're right. At least the last 2 years that I've been here, we have not shown a contingency fund this low at this point in time. But what we have asked, which is very proactive, is that we have asked the department heads to submit their budget adjustments far earlier so that we don't wait till the end of the year. Mm-hmm. There's a mad rush, so to speak, of trying to get budget adjustments in by year end. And if you're familiar with how some of the contingency budget adjustments happen in prior years, is that they're coming to you well after the first of the next year. So we're still doing budget amendments for the former year well into January and February of the succeeding year. We're trying to get away from that. For planning purposes, we'd like to bring at least the larger budget amendments, the ones that are five and six figures, we'd like to bring those to the legislature in time so that you have the ability to monitor this, to ask questions, to ask them to do something. It's not always just supplanting the funds and giving more money. Sometimes you may want to give direction on what not to do. You know, I think Joe mentioned earlier this summer that when there's constrictions to the budget, and this is definitely a constriction, when the contingency is gone or almost gone, you may change some management operations. Just like when sales tax figures came in very low, we implemented a soft freeze in hiring. And so I'd like for the legislature to get these large budget adjustments earlier in the fiscal year, such as September, October, November, December, so there's still time to proactively make changes, and instead of waiting until the whole year is done, and then we're trying to cover all these holes. And the best thing for me, and that works to my advantage, is if the department heads step up and they're responsible to take care of their budgets and doing these budget adjustments all throughout the year, then I don't have to do them or quite as many at the end of the year. Because what I noted in our budget meeting earlier was that you vested in the finance director the ability to transfer funds. You pass a resolution that says the finance director has the authority to transfer funds wherever he needs it, basically, to patch holes or deficits in the budget. And that's, quite honestly, almost too big a task to vest in one person. I don't think anybody would like to come in and work for 4 weekends to do 200 budget adjustments long after the year is closed. So we're trying to bring these to you in a more proactive fashion.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true, but for me the more meaningful point is if you get this a red flag in June or July or August, you don't – the year hasn't gone by already. You might be able to make some adjustments in the remainder of the year. So the question is, what happens if the last $18,000 just gets used up? Would we just go to the general fund or what?
Yeah, you go to the fund balance. It is very possible that we'll exhaust the contingency this year, and we would have to go to our reserves to do that. I mean, I note here there are a couple of anomalies in here. The $200,000 in mental health. That was really a surprise, hasn't happened. I think that's an outlier, so that really hit the contingency pretty hard this year. But yeah, if we exhaust it, and we may well, we'll have to go into the general fund balance.
Point of information about this sheet Martha's talking
point of
about?
Information, go ahead.
So where do we get a copy of this sheet?
Did this go to the budget committee? Did that just go to the budget committee? It was on my desk.
Right here, you can have mine.
We can make sure folks get copies of that.
Not much left, 17K. There you go, knock yourself out.
You have it, it's okay.
Julie? Yes.
I'm glad that Rick is alerting to departments where he sees a need for information and adjustments earlier. I am not so supportive of having us deplete the contingent account based on large estimates. I'd rather see us act on actual expenses at this time of year, and then if we can see that the handwriting looks bad, one of the things that we could do as a legislature is replenish the contingent fund from the general fund if we thought that was a good idea. We know that eventually it's going to have to be filled from that source anyway.
Thank you. Thank you, Rick.
Can I ask?
Oh, I'm sorry, Carol. You have another question?
Yeah, another question on this. So from something that you said towards the middle of this, one of the opportunities of doing this earlier would be to be able to look and see for each department, is there a chance to adjust internally from the expected expenditures for the rest of the year? So if we're doing it in mid-year or October, we still leaves us a few more months, that gives the department a chance to say, well, we were going to do X in this year, but maybe we can't. Is that another valid response to seeing midway through the year that you've got to go into contingency and you're over budget by the, well, Joe mentioned the $200,000 is an unusual situation, but in a department that's having this happen and it's growing.
Yeah, I think if part of your question in the beginning was, can they find monies elsewhere in their budgets? And in many cases, they do. And the first question we ask them is, can they go back and find all of this or some of this or none of this in the existing framework of their budget? Since most of these large ones here are personal services, are basically salary, wages, and fringes, pretty much the answer is no on that account because that's such a large component of their budget. But what you're asking for, if they can find monies in other line items to help cover, and those are called budget transfers, which we probably do about 10 or 15 of those compared to each one of these that you see here at the legislative level, and those you don't even see those because they are doing that all along. They are making budget transfers all year, moving money from one unit to another, one line item to another, and we encourage that. In fact, that's the first question either Joe or I will ask him is, how much of this can you fund from your existing budget? But unfortunately, in a lot of these big ones, that money's not available to them.
All right. Thank you again. Let's move on. Are there any resolutions to be added or withdrawn from the agenda? Guess not. Let's go to the consent agenda. I'll read the appointments. Out of Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee to the Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee, Todd Van Orman. Out of Government Operations Committee to the Board of Assessment Review, Edie Spaulding. There's a municipal recommendation to the Youth Services Board, and that's Ronnie Handaway. We'll go to the resolutions on consent. If you want them off, just say so. Out of Public Safety, Resolution A, authorization to accept Triad Foundation donation and budget adjustment, Sheriff's Office. That's ID 5808. Out of Health and Human Services Committee, Resolution B, budget adjustment in order to accept grant from New York State Office for the Aging Long-Term Care Ombudsman Program, out of the Office for the Aging, ID 5859. Resolution C, grant acceptance and authorization to the New York State Direct Care Worker Program Office, Worker Program, out of the Office for the Aging, ID 5858. Resolution D, authorization to increase hours, WIC Nutrition Educator 2, Health Department, ID 5856. From the Government Operations Committee, Resolution E, appointment of election commissioner for 2016 to 2017. It's ID 5848. Resolution F, establishing standard work days for elected and appointed officials of Tompkins County. That's ID 5839. Resolution G, urging passage of Senate Bill S4964A and Assembly Bill A8201.
Off.
Resolution H, approval of 2015 amendment to the Municipal Cooperative Agreement for the Greater Tompkins County Municipal Health Insurance Consortium. That's ID 5810. And we've done the other two resolutions there. Can I have a motion for the consent agenda, please? Moved by Lesland, seconded by Peter. Discussion. All those in favor of the consent agenda and appointments, please raise your hand. Those opposed, that's unanimous. All right, we'll go to standing committees. Charter Review Committee. The Charter Review Committee will meet tomorrow at 3 o'clock. We have the Budget, Capital, and Personnel Committee. Jim Dennis is the chair.
Thank you very much, Michael. I have a couple of resolutions. Resolution K, it is a budget adjustment and appropriation of unspent funds from 2014 prior years to various accounts of the department that report to the Budget, Capital, Personnel Committee, and I would move that. And this is all rollover operation.
His motion. Is there a second? Seconded by Glenn Morey. Discussion? Dooley?
I'm looking at packet page 85. And the bottom of that is a future uses section. And the last question on it, is the department in a position to return all or part of the rollover? And there's no answer. I just wondered what the answer is.
It is the personnel department, right?
Yes.
Yeah, if you don't see a positive response here, it means they prefer to keep this in their account and available for their use in the future.
Well, in general, that question is answered. By not having it answered, it made me wonder.
Item L is...
Wait a minute. We got to vote. And I think it takes a short form roll call, please.
Ms. Kiefer?
Yes.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Are there any no's? That passes unanimously. Now you can move to the next one, Jim.
All right. I will. We are scheduling a public hearing on 2016 Tompkins County budget and the 2016 to 2020 Tompkins County capital program, and I would move that.
Is there a second? Seconded by Martha.
And just for your information, it is November 10th, Monday, at 7 p.m. right here.
Carol, was that your question?
No.
Go ahead.
So my question is about the period of time for the capital program. In some years, as part of our budget process, when we're going through a new capital program, we've had much lengthier presentations and gone into much more detail on the capital program. And I'm trying to remember, so this is a four-year period that this hearing, the title of this resolution in here.
It's actually five.
5 years.
5 years. Okay, five-year period, 16 through 20, okay, inclusive of those years. So five-year period. Is this a whole new capital program, or are we adding a year onto it?
Their approved program.
That's a good point. So 3 or 4 years ago, we went through our 20-year capital plan, and we updated it, refreshed it, put new programs in, and that went through a very long, methodical process. We're now in the process of implementing that plan, basically. So the capital program that's in the budget is really marginally different than the one from the year before. It brings one more year in. When I did the presentation the other night, I tried to highlight the projects that were either new, and there were very few of them, or had changed from the year before. And it's a very small handful of projects that had changed from the 2015 to 2019 plan. So if you'd like to review it, it's a section of the budget, but I think you may be thinking, Carol, about that much longer in-depth process when we revamp the 20-year program.
Yeah, in earlier years where every year I would get out my one from the year before and see how the changes worked. So next year when we do this, will we be hearing and approving the 2017 to 2021 budget?
Yeah, it's in five-year increments.
So we're not approving the whole 5 years now.
Correct.
Thank you.
Yep. Jim, I think you may have misspoken about the date of the public hearing. The resolution tells us it's November 10th. Which is a Tuesday. Or I'm sorry, it's a Monday, excuse me.
Oh, did I say Tuesday?
Monday's the 9th.
Oh, there's an error. Okay, I'm hearing now that there's an error in the resolution we need to fix here.
Well, that's not my fault.
No. You moved it.
When is the public hearing? when is it, Kath?
Tuesday, November 10th.
Oh, didn't I say November 10th?
So you moved November. This, Jim, with the correction of Monday to change to Tuesday, is that correct?
Okay.
In line 8.
Monday, then I'll move that same resolution with Tuesday, November 10th.
Thank you. Sorry if I confuse matters. Will?
That was my point.
Who else? Dooley?
This is for Joe. In connection with the handful of projects that have changed, will there be updated PAR forms available?
Yes. In fact, I think the PAR forms in the budget are updated to reflect those changes. So if you look at that section of the budget, I believe those PAR forms, yeah. are in there.
Okay, wait, now
it's the abbreviated version, Dooley. I think you like the longer version.
It's
so
the longer
if you'd like
version
to see
I
that,
mean.
We can make that available. For the budget, I think it's a two-page version of each PAR form, and those are updated. I can show you the longer
it's
version
the longer
if you'd
one
like
that
to.
I would like to see. Thank
Fine.
You.
Carol, for a clarification.
Well, no, I just wanted. So then when do you anticipate, Jim, us having a vote on the budget itself? The final vote on the budget. If the hearing is the 10th, are you anticipating that our legislature final vote on the budget would be November
17th?
No, I think 1 week.
1 week. 1 week.
I think the second meeting in November.
Yeah, I don't have.
All right. Ready to vote on the resolution? All those in favor of setting the public hearing, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That's unanimous. Anything else, Jim?
October 26th, we will have a full-blown budget committee, normal budget committee, not dealing with the expanded budget or any of that. It will, and we will talk about the evaluation of the four directs that we have been reluctant to do for the last 3 years, so we really need to get going and work on evaluating the four directs, and that would be two of those people, three of those people there, four of those people, all four of those people right there. So we will begin that discussion on October 26th, 4 p.m. right here. And that concludes my report.
Any other questions for Jim? Thank you, Jim. Old Library Committee, there's no report. We have not met. Public Safety Committee, Jim Dennis. We're still
well, thank you.
Acting Chair.
Is there any, if I could get one more committee, I could just fill up my whole week. But at any rate, we had a Public Safety Committee meeting this afternoon and spoke about the $306,000 or whatever it was, having to do with the sheriff's overtime budget and a variety of other things. We had a short presentation of the reentry program that you saw later on. So, again, it was a one-hour meeting, and I can't recall anything else coming up that we voted on. Let me just move to the resolutions. I have a Reso M. Appropriation from contingent fund, replacement pay, sheriff's office, law enforcement, and I would move that. It's $32,000, three employees out of medical leave greater than 2 months.
Is there a second? Seconded by Lesland. Discussion? All in favor, please raise your hand. I'm sorry, Dooley has a question.
You've
got to get your hand up quicker, Dooley.
My right shoulder is bad. I'll try to use my left hand. Have all of them gone back to work now?
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay, can we vote? Those in favor, please raise your hand. Oh, she tells me I need a short form roll call here. Sorry.
Ms. Kiefer?
Yes.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Are there any no's? That's unanimous.
Resolution N, budget adjustment appropriation. From unspent funds from 2014 prior years to various accounts of the department that report to the Public Safety Committee and Budget and Capital Personnel Committees, I would move that.
Is there a second?
It is rollover.
Seconded by Dave McKenna. Discussion? Another short form roll call, please.
Ms. Kiefer?
Yes.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Any no's? That's unanimous.
No.
Mike?
Sorry.
That's unanimous. Go ahead.
Resolution O, appropriation from contingent fund, replacement paid, Department of Probation, Community Justice, and I would move that.
Is there a second? Seconded by Martha.
It is $9,997.
Discussion? Short form roll call?
Ms. Kiefer?
Yes.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Any no's? Unanimous. Pete?
P, appropriation from contingent fund for personnel and board out costs, and I would move that.
Is there a second? Seconded by Martha. Discussion? Another short form roll call.
Ike.
Oh, who's up? Didn't see it. All right. Carol, is your hand up too?
Yeah, but mine is Martha.
Dooley, then Carol, and then Martha.
Oh, okay.
Now Martha was a second. Go ahead.
What function does this cover, and for what period of time?
It's the anticipated just cost of overrun in the overtime budget that we've been talking about here.
So it's just overtime.
Joe, can you respond?
Almost. The last item in here is the board out costs. So $78,000 of the resolution is for anticipated overages in the board out of prisoners. The rest of it is overtime.
Julie, it's the whole discussion we've been just having here about the contingent fund and why the contingent fund is now down to $18,000.
Yes, and so that's why I'll be voting against this. Just wanted to make sure.
Oh, well, fine. So that means Mike will have to, well, you know what to do.
Thank you. Carol's up next.
Yeah, I voted against this in committee. I really sympathize with our sheriff's department having, had a series of extra expenditures this year. But this is $360,000, and the $200,000 that Joe mentioned before was an outlier. I mean, this is, almost not quite twice that. And we had asked, this came to committee earlier, a few months ago, and we had asked for additional information, and then we didn't get additional information until in the meeting, where we had only time to review it during the meeting, that showed going back into time how there's been overages in this department. And I think after we took the vote in committee, it also came out based on Dooley's question that didn't get answered here, about what period of time these estimates were covering. And their estimates through now, but the actual figures, we really only have through July. So it's possible that something's been made up since then. And we still have a few months left of the year. So I felt fairly strongly in committee that we obviously have to do some of this, but that we didn't necessarily, it's not the end of the year yet, need to do the entire $360,000 now, and that we should be asking the department head, in this case the sheriff, to be going back and seeing, can you make up any of this before the end of the year in expenses that you might be able to put off? It's the responsibility of each department head to try to stay on budget. We stretch it hurts till it really hurts on behalf of the taxpayers each year, to try to create a budget that works for everybody across departments. And it's not fair to go on and get out of balance by the end of each year. I thought about trying to separate some of these. It's a list of, 9 or 10 different items, and I thought about, well, let's try to approve some of these and not others, and I don't know if I'd want to be in the position of picking for the department which ones are most important to pay off now and make sure that we're covering versus trying to balance the budget other ways. But I'm not sure that I've heard anything. First, I want to verify, is it true that these numbers really were only numbers that we had accurately through the end of July? Might any of it have gotten any better than our estimates that, again, were made back in July but not updated? And I'm just not sure. I need to hear more to get me to change my vote from committee.
I believe the county administrator can. And then Brian, if he wants to come to the microphone at some point. But let Joe do this part of it.
So after committee, I ran back and pulled up the computer to look at what the spending is through September and how that may affect the numbers that are in front of you. And it really does validate what we have here. So when you combine the two budgets for overtime, road patrol and jail, the combined budgets are $526. They've already spent $622,000. So we're already over. And then there's still 3 months. That's through the end of September. There's still 3 months. So I looked at what if they spent only what's in the budget. And we've just said we are under budget. So if they can stay within the budget, they're going to need about another $175,000. So the numbers that are in front of you are very close to the mark. They're within like $6,000 or $7,000 of where the numbers would end if they get back on track and they stay right within their budget in the last 3 months of the year. And again, the trend is they've been going over the budget. So I think the numbers that you have in front of you are as good as we're going to get with respect to projection. It seems to be holding pretty true. And with respect to the period that we're talking about, this should carry us through the end of the year. So by the end of the year, if they're close, if they're good, Rick won't have to look for more adjustments to be able to balance those accounts.
So there's another thing that I'm having trouble wrapping my brain around here, which is we're told repeatedly that in terms of policy about how to assign and how to run the department, because the sheriff is an independently elected officer, we don't have much discretion about that. What we have discretion over is the budget, not the policies that lead to the increased spending. So if we don't do something at this stage, how do we find out at what stages we can influence, again, so that the kinds of programs we heard about earlier tonight that might keep people out of the jail, so we avoid some of these costs, so we'll have money to do that. So I'm just at a loss.
We've got a lot of people that want to speak, Carol.
Is there an answer?
I don't know if that's.
Where else can we influence this if not here?
Martha, I've got you in the list here. Brian, did you want Brian to speak, Jim? Robinson is our undersheriff.
Brian at the microphone that answer a question that's answerable.
Use your microphone, please.
I want Brian at the microphone to answer a question that's answerable, okay?
All right. Then let's go. I've got Martha, Leslin, Jim, and Peter. Martha?
Okay, let me try to answer. There's no the policy about who's in the jail about staffing the corrections officers is set by the architecture of the jail, and that is set by the and based on the facility itself. Even if nobody were in the jail, we need certain positions staffed 24/7, and that's Commissioner of Corrections. That's architecture. That's not negotiable. It's not an issue of policy. The overtime in the jail does relate to the board outs because there's a certain some amount of the overtime has to do with driving people to other counties. So if you've got somebody who was supposed to be in the building having to drive somebody to Tioga County, you have to fill up that space. So when we look at the boarding out costs, which are higher because, remember, we thought we'd have those extra 7 beds already in place, and therefore, you know, some 0 to 7 more people in our facility instead of boarded out every night, and that project's taken longer than we expected. That's not open yet. We thought we'd have that up in June or something.
Early in the year.
So projections assumed we would have 7 more beds than we have right now. So that's one reason. Those are reasons that this year is out of whack. What I want to just confirm, Joe, you said the combined jail and road overtime for the year would have been $526,000?
The budget, so I've got $526,000 combined. And they've already spent $622,000. Okay. And there's 3 months left.
Okay. What we got in committee, what Carol said was, you know, we got in committee, were these graphs, and I don't know if everybody else got them yet, but these are the history of from 2009 of these expenses up to 2015. And Brian pointed out that the person who would have sent these to our staff, so the committee and the legislature would have gotten them, was out with a broken arm. And he promised he hadn't broken her arm. But so that was why we didn't have the information ahead of time. But here's the information, very easy to see in graph form. I was ready in committee this afternoon to vote against this appropriation, but seeing this information and having Brian explain lots of other stuff too, I voted for it, and I think it's prudent we have to do it. It's good that we have a process now that says in June or July or August we should pay attention to this, but we can't make these costs go away. Over the long term, the policies we have some control over, it is true, might, we hope, lead to fewer people in trouble, therefore fewer people incarcerated, et cetera. But again, even if nobody were in the jail, we have to staff it.
Leslie.
Thank you. I'm looking at the numbers here. Is the $78,000 board out cost what is paid to the other institution for housing our inmates? That's just what's paid. That does not include the staff time.
That's correct.
That's just to pay.
That's correct.
And could you please remind me what premium pay is?
It's another element of overtime.
Say more.
It's, I think we've put in here where officers receive double time for certain duties, so it's in a dip, but it's a part of the overtime package.
I'm not sure I get that fully. So this might be the double time or time and a half that might be paid beyond a certain number of hours or something. Is that what you're referring to?
Yeah. Brian, can you mention?
Sure. Some of it's like holiday overtime. It's all contractual. The rates may differ depending on that, depending on RDO, which is a regular day off. If you call somebody
okay.
in
so
on their day off,
that don't fall
yeah.
into the regular overtime cost. And this is a little bit related. Perhaps this was said in Public Safety Committee. But why is it taking so long for the construction for the new cells? What's going on with that?
It got off to a late start, Leslie. So the pace of construction has been going okay. I think we had a setback with one of the panels, the roofing panels. It's a long precast panel that goes across. I think that set us back for a little bit, but generally it was getting off to a slow start. And I think a part of that relates to the fact that that Arell was out for a while, and he's our guy, so that got us off to a slow start.
And then my last question is, I'm going to assume that all of the overtime is not attributed to just board outs. What else is causing the overtime?
The vast majority would be. Are you talking about jail? Because that's a little bit easier to.
I'm looking at all of it. I just have one sheet of paper that just tells me money. All I see here.
Do you have these, Leslie?
I have these. Yes, I got these on my desk.
If I could for just a second and kind of generalize, and maybe it'll help to clear some of this up. First off, I don't ever remember in my 5 years on the legislature ever doing something like this. This was something that was brought to our attention by county administration and finance. And basically, it boils down to realistic budgeting. And if you refer to the jail overtime and board out cost charts, you can see in green where the budgeted costs are exceeded by the actual costs yearly. That means one of two things. Either you folks aren't giving the department enough to cover that cost, or the department isn't asking for that money to cover those costs and isn't recognizing actual costs. And I believe this resolution is an attempt to do that moving forward. I don't mind, as somebody that monitors the budget, should these be, I'll say, properly funded based on actual costs, a look back of actual costs. Then on June 30th of each year, on every one of the budget lines, you should be able to go across and you should come up with a figure of right around 50%. That would be holding someone to the costs that should be. And again, I wasn't even looking in this direction until it was brought to our attention by Joe and Rick. One of the OTRs that you have this year is an attempt to do this, that exact thing, for the jail for next year's budget. When you look at the road overtime and discount 2009 and 2010, there are ebbs and flows in that. Some years it's over, some years it's under. For this particular year, if you wanted to know about events, obviously the bill for Hornbrook came in 2015. We did some other details on Kendall Ave for the Ithaca College students. Some overtime was expended with the situation that we had at the second dam. I know we're having a meeting this Thursday on that. So things come up, events come up, and that may not occur next year. So that deficit may not even be there, and you may have something that like what happened in 2012, where there was actually almost $50,000 less spent on overtime than what was budgeted. So that's not, you know, we'll work with that. But it appears as though, in looking back, that the budgeted amounts for jail overtime and board outs consistently fall short. And so to expect that we would be able to rob from Peter to pay Paul on a personnel line, which are big figures, most of our lines are small figures, you know, equipment lines that are $10,000, $12,000. I mean, that doesn't even touch any of this. Hopefully that begins to make this situation a bit clearer for people. It's money that's spent. It's already spent. The bill's got to be paid. I would much rather do as Rick suggests and have the money in the bank and be held responsible for the actual budget. I just don't think it, certainly in the last 6 years, as the numbers bear out, it has never been sufficient.
Leslin, you still have the floor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, $50,000 worth of an MBA and I can't read a chart, boo. Brian, help me out here. This is year-to-date to what month? This here chart that you gave us.
Yes.
Year-to-date to what month? Now or July or June? Or?
believe it was through the end of August.
Through the end of August.
Yes.
So I'm looking at board outs 2015 year to date.
Yes.
Actual at that point is less than what was budgeted.
Yes.
Am I reading that right?
You are.
So how are we arriving at a projection through the end of the year that is almost twice as much as where we are now? Well, we only have a couple of months left.
Yep. I don't know. These projected one. Many times, I do know, and maybe I should have Ray to help me out because he actually does the jail.
Come on, Ray. He doesn't know he's right. Come on. That's my buddy.
I know enough to ask for help. I do know that. There's a bit of a lag time many times in the billing from other jails. You know, you don't end the end of the month and get a bill. I mean, it comes. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yep.
So this is that's what's being assumed here, that we have some outstanding bills, so that by the end of the year we are going to see our board out costs be almost twice as much in what you've presented here as year to date.
Yes, so that 129 is money that was actually spent then.
Right.
Yes. And for the methodology,
I
would have to defer to Joe.
Yeah, I can speak to it. So, and I'm going to go backward a little bit too, to kind of tell you how we've come to this point. Our goal is to be able to do projections every month, so that early in the year we can catch things before they get to a point where they're really too large to be able to deal with. It really speaks to Carol's point. If we can detect something early in the year, it's easier for us to find remedies for it. So the way we project is we look at what the trend has been over the last 5 or 6 years by month. How much have we spent by month in each of these spending categories? So we can see, and this is a little different than Brian's point, often you don't spend half your money at the end of June. There are cyclical patterns. There are seasonal patterns that you see in the spending that you need to take into account when you do projections. So I think what's happening on the board outs is that we see toward the end of the year, historically, our spending goes up beyond what you see in the earlier months of the year. So we try to build that into the equation. So that's what has driven this number, the 129, which was probably an August number, to where we think it's going to be by the end of the year. It's based on what we've seen happen in history over the last 5 or 6 years.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I just have one other point.
Okay.
And, you know, probation and OAR and the county attorney's office did a very good presentation tonight on reentry. I remember last year's budget, we added a position to OAR to help with sort of the more people we can help bail out of jail, the more. I am wondering if we can perhaps get a good look at all of these things to see how are things working. Are there more people being bailed out of jail? Is there less money in OARs, bail fund, that they can't do it, so we're ending up where we are now? Because part of the reason for adding that is so we lessen the number of people that we have in the jail. We have to board out a number of those things, building, you know, many more cells, et cetera. So I'm hoping that we can sort of take a general look at all of those to see how things are working and if there are other things that need to be done, because board out cuts are really getting out of hand. I'm looking at it at this point. It, you know, had been reduced at some point, but now we're trending upwards again. So I'd love to see that looked at to see how things are working there or if we have to sort of revisit and do things differently. Thank you.
All right. Here's what I have. I've got Jim, Peter, and Martha, and then I'd like to vote. Jim?
I passed.
Martha? I'm sorry. Peter?
No, I don't think I have anything to add to this
Martha?
Discussion.
I think that's a good item for the Public Safety Committee about the OAR, a bail report. Tonight, Deb Dietrich did say just anecdotally, that she sees a lot of the rural justices increasing the bail amounts so that there's a limit. And I think there's a new statutory limit as far as they can only, there's a lower level that they can do according to state law. So, but I think that's an important topic.
Let's proceed to a vote. Roll call, please.
Long form.
Long form roll call. We had some people saying they're going to vote against it.
May I ask just one more question?
Yes.
Sorry. So if we, if this is voted in for to cover costs, because obviously we have to pay the bills, then it's in the budget, and if all of it is not spent because this is projected, then it becomes rollover in this department's budget. No, this is just one
great
time
point,
to pay
though.
The bills.
Great point. If it's not spent, it falls into fund balance. A few years ago, we took payroll savings out of the rollover mix.
Okay.
So this will come back to the general fund.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Please call the roll.
Ms. Kiefer?
No.
Mr. Klein?
Yes.
Mrs. McBean-Claiborne?
Yes.
Mr. McKenna?
Yes.
Mr. Morey?
Yes.
Ms. Robertson?
Yes.
Mr. Sigler?
Yes.
Mr. Stein?
Yes.
Mr. Burbank?
Yes.
Ms. Chalk?
No.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Mr. Lane?
Yes. Does anyone want to change his or her vote? Please announce the vote.
10 ayes, 2 noes.
That passes. Jim, does that complete your report?
Yes, thankfully. I believe the next committee meeting is October 19th, you know, and that's a Monday. So the Public Safety Committee meeting will be October 19th and on Monday.
We will take a 10-minute break. Please be back by 20 of. We'll finish the standing committees and then go into executive session. Okay, let's get back in our seats. Let's proceed. Let's go to Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee. Leslie McBean-Claiborne is the chair.
We went home.
Oh, then we'll move on.
WDIC has been working. We've been working hard. We have, following the board and department heads retreat, we were able to identify a number of members within our Tompkins County workplace community who were interested in being a part of a steering committee to move forward the agenda of items that came out from the survey and from the retreat that we had. We had some big topics, and so that committee has met. Out of that committee, we have also, or out of that survey and retreat, Paul is also working on getting the focus groups sort of established, finding the members of the public who can host those groups, people who are skilled in hosting, who are skilled in this subject matter. So we are busy working on moving things forward with that, and most importantly, trying to make sure that we have a clear and effective communications plan so that our workforce knows that we are doing something. It's just not another survey that's up on the shelf, that we are feverishly working on the items that they identified as important to them. So we have had a few meetings, not just to meet, but really action steps, and folks are working hard. We've had Christina Dravis from DUOR and Tom Knight from Planning, who have agreed to sort of co-chair the movement, which is exciting. So it's not all falling on Paul or I. So it's exciting to get more county employees involved and eager to move things forward. So stay tuned. More information to follow as we work on that. especially also just trying to get a gather from within just information about how, you know, the general workforce receives any kind of regulation or mandate or new policy or anything that comes out. How does it get communicated to them? How do they know what's going on within county government, not just within the own silo of your own department, but seeing what that looks like and seeing how we can help support or tweak it so that everyone feels that they are informed and included in the process. Earlier tonight, Mike, you appointed Todd to the Workforce Diversity and Inclusion Committee. We have more employees who are really interested in taking a role in this, and more managers and supervisors, department heads, who are being extremely encouraging. So there's work to be done, and we're moving it along. These folks love to meet at 8 o'clock in the morning, and then y'all want to meet until 10 at night. It's killing me, but I'm trying. So that's my report. We're doing things and moving along.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. Let's go to Health and Human Services Committee. Peter Stein is chair.
Yeah, we had a meeting last Thursday, and I looked through my notes coming over here, and I really didn't have anything very interesting to say about that meeting. The resolutions that we addressed were that we passed were all on the consent agenda, and they were routine resolutions that really don't need any discussion. The only thing that we talked about, which I found sort of interesting but have nothing to report on except just bring it up, is a question of what happens when we decide that we want to that we want to provide a service for that would require making one of our employees work longer hours. Do we have the right to do that, or is it the employee's right to say, no, I don't want to work longer hours? And I was surprised to learn, I would have thought that we would have a uniform policy, but apparently not. And it differs from place to place, and I just wondered why that would be or why we wouldn't have a uniform policy. The reason that comes to my mind is because in TCAT, the drivers are required to drive as many hours as they need to drive. And sometimes we, because people are sick, drivers have to work and do overtime that they don't want to do. But nonetheless, that's not their decision to make. If the organization says they have to drive, they have to drive. So anyway, that's all I have to report.
Questions, Will?
Well, Peter, as you may recall, I was the one that sort of raised that, and we got responses from several of the different departments. And I have a sort of different perspective, which is that frequently asking to be work a half an hour more or whatever can be very disruptive to one's family life, right, or whatever. And I was very, very happy to hear that in general the policy is to try to talk with employees and see if something can be accommodated. So, you know.
Yeah, obviously it's better to be accommodating than not be accommodating, but if you have something very important that has to be done, then maybe you don't. So, and that's all I have to report.
Jim, then Carol.
Peter, they're union employees, right? They operate with a contract. I mean, the contract.
That's in their contract, right?
That was the other thing.
Carol?
Yeah, I sort of heard the answer a little differently. So I think that what we resolved, I think we turned around and asked, was it Joe or somebody, to find out whether there's in fact a policy, and he was going to check with our personnel director, but that the responses from the different department heads was that in the areas in which they might have flexibility, they would, for the most part, be asking, and it would be a conversation, but that there are some areas that where, you know, like you pointed out a good example, where you just don't have the discretion, you got to cover the hours, but that we were sort of weren't sure what the policy was yet, and nobody in the room was sure exactly what it was, and we were going to find out the answer and get a report. Is that?
Dave?
Yeah, I'd just like to point out that there is a limit on the number of hours a person with CDL can drive.
Right. Okay. Anything else for Peter? Thank you, Peter.
Well, I could, and I think this probably ought to go to the personnel right. committee too, but I did talk to Amy, and at least under the white collar contract, it's within management's rights to change hours, but there's a required 14-day period of a notification period to the employee. So that's the way the white collar contract reads. But I do think if this is a topic, it's one that we ought to talk to Amy about in the personnel committee.
Yeah, because I interpret that.
They're not our employees. They're not our employees.
Jim, you need to use your microphone, please.
No,
they're not our employees.
No, our white collar employees.
Oh,
that's the
right.
way it, yeah.
Okay. Thank you, Peter. Let's go to Facilities and Infrastructure Committee. David McKenna is the chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. FNIA has not met since our last meeting, but we are scheduled to meet on October 12th, which is Columbus Day, so there will no be, excuse me, there will not be a meeting that day either. Current plan is to meet before the legislature meeting on the 20th. The time will be announced, and I have one resolution, Resolution Q, Document ID 5819, Budget Adjustment and Appropriation of Unspent Funds from 2014 and prior years to various accounts of the departments that report to F&I Committee. And I so move.
Is there a second? Seconded by Glenn Morey. Discussion. Short form roll call, please.
Ms. Kiefer?
Yes.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Are there any no's? That's unanimous.
And that concludes my report.
Questions for Dave? Economic Development Committee, Martha Robertson is chair.
Thank you, Mike. We met yesterday, and we approved tourism capital grant awards that will come to you at the next legislature meeting. We also want to mention that the Planning Department got a grant, $49,000 and change, for farmers market promotion from the USDA. We had a great presentation by Ed Marks of the Energy Roadmap, and it was, I think it was the fourth time I've seen a presentation on it, but it's like I'm starting to now understand it, so maybe that's how many presentations you need to have. But it was very good conversation. Some members hadn't seen it at all. We had three visitors from REV, from the incubator on right now on the Commons, three women from the Women Entrepreneurs Program. They call it Passenger to Pilot. And so you can imagine there, you know, to go from the, you know, the worker to the owner, to the business owner, that's what passenger to pilot means. And they talked about what it means to be the particular challenges of being a woman entrepreneur and also the advantages and opportunities. And they have a great mentorship program. Mildred Warner from Cornell came down from the planning department and talked to us about community development and economic development and child care, and really with some very concrete ideas about how we should really be looking at child care, not as welfare, not as education even, but as economic development. And then it was interesting because then the women entrepreneurs really piped in, and one of them specifically said, look, as my child care expenses have gone down, my ability to be productive economically has gone up. And she's seen it really fluctuate in over the life course of her family. So that was it was really inspiring to have Mildred there. But then I also want to connect this to a document that actually Tom Knight offered to us, and we had the committee read Child Care and Community Development. It's a Planning for Family-Friendly Communities, a briefing paper, and talked about how we think about some smart growth or denser development that will support more livable communities. We think about jobs and housing together and the services. We don't think about child care. But during the, I mean, up to 10 or more years that a family is trucking kids back and forth to one or another child care program, that's the source of many, many vehicle miles traveled. Now, this connects to the energy roadmap that I think all of us will, you know, really have an opportunity to see soon. The energy roadmap identifying that perhaps our largest problem to reduce greenhouse gas emissions is going to be how to cut 25% of our vehicle miles traveled in the next 35 years while our population actually grows. So to connect the dots, the idea that we should be planning child care and family-friendly communities in concert with housing and transportation services, I think is really critical. And I mentioned this to Ed. We had just talked about this paper, and I mentioned it to Ed because he was there for the roadmap, and he said, well, we didn't do human services in the comprehensive plan at all. Because it's not in the comprehensive plan. There's nothing about family friendly. There's nothing about child care. And then I thought later, well, that's the whole problem with the mindset. It's not a human service. It's a generator of economic development. It's a generator of vehicle miles traveled. We ought to really be looking at this. So I'm going to pass this paper to Dooley. I hope that the planning committee can think about it, take a look, and see where that goes. There are decisions that we're going to be making that we make with respect to land use that determine our vehicle miles traveled for 35, 50 years because of where things are located. So there may be things that can be done that actually don't cost the public sector anything if you just relook at zoning. And obviously we don't have zoning, but if you relook at those issues from a community planning point of view. So it was a really interesting discussion. You know, there's lots more that we covered. The next meeting is November 2nd, and we hope perhaps to bring some people in from the school district, one or more of the school districts, to talk about this issue of child care and universal pre-K, among other things. So.
Questions? Thank you, Martha. Let's go to Government Operations Committee. Dan Klein is the chair.
Thank you, Mike. We had Resolution G pulled from the consent agenda.
Yes.
So I'll move Resolution G, urging passage of Senate Bill S-4964A and Assembly Bill A-8201 by the New York State Legislature to increase the share of revenue counties retain for providing certain Department of Motor Vehicle services.
Is there a second? Seconded by Peter Stein. Dooley, I think you pulled that.
I pulled it, not because I'm opposed to it, but I wanted to say that I think copies should also go to the chairs of the relevant state legislative committees and to NYSAC. That's all.
Is that friendly?
Yes.
Okay. Friendly to the seconder? All right, ready to vote. All those in favor, please raise your hand. Those opposed? That's unanimous.
Okay, and we have Resolution R, budget adjustment and appropriation of unspent funds from 2014 and prior years to various accounts of departments that report to the Government Operations Committee.
Is there a second? Seconded by Glenn Morey. Discussion? Short-form roll call, please.
Ms. Kiefer?
Yes.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Are there any no's? That's unanimous.
So at our meeting in September, we heard from Maureen Reynolds, our county clerk, about the resolution we just voted on, which was basically to reformulate the formula used to determine how much our local DMV gets compared to the state. And her estimate is that if that was passed, it would bring in $550,000 to $600,000 more locally than we're getting right now. And I just want to be really clear, this is not extra tax money. This is not money that our residents are going to be paying. This is money that the state is getting right now that instead the county would get, where a lot of the work is being done and where the residents live. Maureen also told us about a change that is probably going to be happening with commercial driver's licenses, with CDLs. We have a test facility here that we run over 100 people go through it every year to get certified, to get their licenses. And there's been a change in the federal policy about the size that these things have to be and some of the other formulations of it. So it looks like ours is not going to pass muster. And New York State is responding to that by wanting to regionalize it like they do with a lot of things, which would probably mean that our CDL test site would be in Syracuse. So there are a lot of local people that are interested in keeping it locally if possible. So the county, the city, TCAT, and the school districts are all looking at possibilities of how to keep that test facility local. Also, the other resolution that we just passed about the routine budget adjustments, I just wanted to mention a couple of things we learned when we were digging into that a little bit about how our departments are spending their money. County Attorney's Office 2014 rollover amounted to $1, which is pretty good budgeting. And we also found out the County Information Technology Services, ITS, so their budget adjustments were to get some office furniture using their rollover funds. And they told us that in the last 18 years, they've only spent $600, approximately $600 on office furniture. So it's, I thought that was pretty good demonstration of frugal spending. Next Government Operations Committee is October 27th at 3:30. Hopefully we'll be looking at a drone law, and I will give you more information as that gets closer.
Questions for Dan? Thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
Planning and Energy and Environmental Quality Committee, Dooley Kiefer is the chair.
I have Resolution S, Budget Adjustment and Appropriation of Unspent Funds from 2014 and prior years to various accounts of the departments that report to PEAK.
Is there a second? Seconded by Carol. Discussion? Short form roll call, please.
Ms. Kiefer?
Yes.
Mr. Dennis?
Yes.
Are there any no's? That's unanimous.
Thank you. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, October 21st at 3 p.m. We will have a draft law on microbeads. And we'll have finally time for discussion on what steps we might take to address the issue of coal plant legacy pollution that was brought to us at our previous meeting. And I'm sure there'll be plenty of other things on the agenda.
Questions? Martha?
Will the plant be represented, Jerry Goodenow?
Well, he wasn't able to come this last time, and I've had conversation with him, and he is anxiously awaiting for us to have time to put up on our website, the county website, the PowerPoint from Mark Quarles, accompanied by the verbal description that Mark Quarles gave during that PowerPoint, and that is slowly being transcribed from the screens. Once he's seen that, he will decide whether he wants to come or not. So, yes, he's aware of the next meeting. And you asked me if I'm going to invite him. The last time I called and kept failing to reach him, I will do that again. Or would it be acceptable to simply send him the agenda? And notice, is that not good enough?
No, I think he deserves to be invited, and I understand that. I asked at the committee meeting that we get the slides. Can that we at least get that now and have that put up, whether there's a transcription of his everything that he said? I think that the slides shouldn't be hard to get.
Well, they didn't arrive immediately. I'm not sure what their status is yet.
It's been a couple weeks.
Carol?
Yeah, on this topic, this has come up a couple of times, and as has the issue of the legacy coal ash, and I think starting the very first time we talked about it, it's not clear that the current part of the issue is that it's not clear, nor would we have privy to the information that says that the current owners of the site, this goes back decades, and you would assume in the business world that that risk gets isolated and insulated from owner to owner. So that's one of the concerns. So it's not necessarily that the current plant, that this is an issue of the current
Wouldn't
plant.
The place to start be to ask the current owner?
Well, he's been alerted.
They certainly know. No, he hasn't actually been asked.
I just wouldn't assume that it's their responsibility. That's one of the issues that we're trying to explore.
All right. Thank you. Thank you. Dooley, anything else?
No.
All right. Move to minutes. Remember, we're doing an executive session. Let's take the minutes of September 15th, please. Someone want to move those? Martha, seconded by Peter. Carol?
I think there was an issue that a communication from Kathy Covert about on this one.
On the 15th? I think
on
that was corrected.
On the 15th?
He said it was a manifest error, I think.
Right. Did people, was there something in our packet?
That was corrected. She said it was a manifest. Kathy, do you want to speak to it?
Okay.
I responded and said it was a manifest error, changing the word lenders to renters.
That's been done.
But would people know about that in their packets if they needed to refer to the information?
Oh, my God.
So I was going to ask to have it. I assumed it would be read so people could correct it in their packets.
It was, as I understand it, it was a reporting a comment from the director of Ithaca Neighborhood Housing. There was he talked about lenders. He talked about when he said renters, he meant lenders. Did not mean lenders. So that's been corrected.
Yeah, I have it in front of me. It's that.
Go ahead and read it.
Our minutes had. Had somebody quoted as saying that there were thousands of lenders who live in Tompkins County and beyond its borders who would like to buy homes. So it was just corrected to thousands of renters who would like to buy homes. So it was an error.
That's been done. Thank you for noticing that, Carol. So it got corrected. Now, is there anything else on the September 15th minutes? Someone want to, or shall we vote? All those in favor, please raise your hand. All those opposed? We have one opposed. Let's go to September 17th meeting. Someone want to move those? Jim? Seconded by Mike. Any discussion on that? All in favor, please raise your hand. All those opposed? That's Julie, are you voting?
I guess I don't remember reading them, so I can't abstain. I'll vote for them.
So you're voting no. So one opposed. Okay. Any unfinished business? All right, I'm going to ask for a motion to go into executive session to discuss personnel issues about particular people and also labor negotiations. Is there a motion? Martha, second by Carol. All in favor? That's unanimous. We do not. We'll come back and adjourn. We don't intend to take any action when we come back. So let's take a second and let folks shut down, and then we'll come back and do the executive session. Mm-hmm.